more studies are showing that high blood pressure is only one symptom of an entire systemic imbalance. It is not the cause of stroke or heart disease. Richard Moore, MD and biophysics PhD, shares in his book, The High Blood Pressure Solution, that by maintaining a proper ratio of potassium to sodium in the diet, blood pressure can be regulated at the cellular level, preventing the development of hypertension and the high incidence of strokes and heart attacks. Part one aired last week and is still available for listening. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. You had a quote in your book that said, "In some things, there is no substitute for experience and observation." And I would change that to "in all things." Wouldn't you?
I don't remember where the quote is. Do you remember the page number?
I'm sorry, I don't. It was in the middle somewhere. How's that for not really telling you?
Well, keep in mind, I started off to be a theoretical physicist.
Right.
And that's one of the beautiful things about physics. Physics, in theory and physics, time and again, has made predictions that you never would have gotten on the basis of experience. Well, even the idea of the electron came out of theory. But relativity, the fact that light can has an absolute speed limit, that came out of theory. Have you heard of non-locality?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Well, that's fascinating because it's been proven to exist.
Of course, and there's plenty, I'm well aware of, quite a bit of nonlinear healing that goes on all the time in the planet.
Yeah, well, nonlinear and non-locality are different. Non-locality got started in the equations in quantum physics. I remember when I sat in on a quantum physics course at Purdue in graduate school with my best friend, Dick Deli. And at one point, when he was explaining the way things work, it just felt like our heads swiveled around in a circle. It's a radically different view of reality. And in the equations, you solve an equation for the location of an electron, for example, you'll find that the equation gives you two possible answers. And when you make the measurement, it's going to be one or the other of those two possible answers. That before you make the measurement, in the mathematics, it looks like the electron is in both places at once, but of course, that defies common sense. And so Einstein and Niels Bohr argued about this point all the rest of their lives. My major professor at the end of World War II did a postdoc with Niels Bohr, and he said Niels Bohr was found dead in his office working on a reply to Einstein's latest paper. They weren't publishing these papers. They were writing to each other. They wanted to really understand what reality is like. And Einstein could not believe that these equations were real. They were just a mathematical way to calculate things. Because what they were implying was non-local. There are non-local effects. And non-local means, well, the idea of locality was a fundamental idea in physics, that any reaction or effect always has to be propagated locally, even a light ray. It has to go from here to there continuously. It can't be here and then be there. And in 1965, a theorem was produced by John Bell, which to everybody's shock made it possible to test this. I quit looking at the test results about 8 or 9 years ago. At that time, there had already been over 10 different experiments, different protocols, radically different from each other, all of which confirmed that non-locality really exists. We live in a very magical universe. If two objects tightly interact, they became correlated so that the quantum aspects of each object will depend on the quantum aspects of the other object, even if they're moved apart all the way across the universe. If you change the properties of one, the other one changes instantly. And this is real. I think it's the most important discovery in human history. It shows that Plato's view of reality was right, that the senses that we have perceive are common sense, as I mentioned a while ago, turns out to be common, but not quite right. That there's a more fundamental, non-material, but nevertheless physical, mathematical basis of reality behind the scenes. And what we experience is just a projection, as it were, of that reality. And so how Plato came up with this is beyond me, but he did. And Aristotle, his main student, rejected it. And our modern education is based upon Aristotle.
Well, in my uneducated piece of this, I just feel like it makes it almost impossible then to call something an object, because how is it really separated from everything else?
Well, you touched on a good thing. The universe is an entity, is a whole thing where everything is part of it. And the mechanical view of reality, which is what pre-med students learn about, that's, you know, classical physics, is an illusion. It's a good point you make. And incidentally, that view of reality, which is proven, is anti-common sense. I hate the word common sense. People use common sense when they ought to be using good judgment.
That's something. It depends how you look on it, really. Just what most people call common sense really isn't, and there is a common sense in there somewhere, in that non-local. That's where it is,
yeah,
in the non-local.
Well, non-locality. That ought to be, you know, the clergy should be talking about non-locality. It really means we live in a spiritual universe.
Yes.
And my way of looking at it, this universe exists in the mind of God. And everything is tied together. John Archibald Wheeler, I spent an afternoon with him one time. He was the dean of theoretical physics in the United States. He was the last main collaborator of Albert Einstein. And we were talking about a paper Wheeler had written, which is not why I went to see him, called It From Bit, in which he pointed out that information is probably more important in the structure of the physical universe than energy. And in fact, we now know there's tight mathematical connection between information and energy. You can't have one without the other. But it's just an absolutely amazing, beautiful universe we live in.
When I hear you say that information is more important than energy, I don't know. I don't know if I can agree with that, because I feel information is what divides things up, which I think creates a more difficult understanding or holism.
Well, in our culture, information often divides things up, but that's just the way we think. There's a mathematical relationship between bits of information and joules of energy.
Okay.
You can show that you can't have a signal or a message without it conveying and using information. It's impossible.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, in that nature of reality, when I was 13, because of World War II, I was extremely disillusioned. In retrospect, my dad came back with post-traumatic stress disorder. And on the other hand, he'd been a great hero in my mind and in reality before that. And so I took a vow, which I've lived up to always be a radical skeptic about everything. you know, as I was starting high school, I even doubted whether World War II had existed. You know, maybe we'd been fooled with the newsreels and
right. Like, did we put a man on the moon?
Ridiculous extremes like that. And one thing about that is that eventually you come up a few things that you're so convinced are true that, it gives you a pretty firm background. And one of the views that we all grew up with, unless you're born around 1970 or 80, is that the world is made up of matter, material substance, which is what Aristotle said. And in high school, I read Plato and understood what he was talking about in his famous allegory of the cave, where he said, you know, imagine there's a cave where people are chained together facing a wall, and at the back, their back is the opening to the cave where light comes in. But they cannot look any place except straight at the wall. And that's all they ever see. They get to thinking that those shadows are the reality. And the reality is much more complex than that.
Exactly. So how do you relate that, Richard, to medicine and healing? Yes, very positively, you have shown, and others have shown, that the 16-to-1 ratio of the potassium...
Well, normal is 12-to-16, yeah.
Right, ratio. And yet there are so many other factors in that unseen, in those shadows, when you're working with someone to help them have optimum health.
Well, in reality, it's all based on mathematics. Physics really tells us. The physics was started on the belief that it's all based on mathematics, which goes back to the ancient Egyptians, and in Pythagoras and Plato both studied in Egypt, where they got this idea and developed it further. And a lot of current-day philosophers, I used to sit in our discussions of the philosophy department when they were talking about Plato, and they were frankly ignorant. They would laugh about the fact that Plato said, you know, the world is based upon mathematical forms, and like triangles and cubes and so on. Well, the kind of mathematics Plato had be aware of was very primitive, and cubes and forms like that were the only kind of forms you could think of. But today, quantum physics shows that reality is based upon mathematical forms. They're much more complex than cubes and triangles and so on. And that statement is radically different from the view of our culture, so much so that a lot of people would say, well, that's nonsense. But it's not nonsense. I mean, that's the way it really is. And that's also where this connectivity comes in, like non-locality, that shows us that everything is connected. If one of the things that my research was related to, but not directly on, is the origin of life. And as a result, I was invited to participate in a couple of years in Gordon Research Conference's Origin of Life discussions. And one of the absolutely amazing, when I was a little boy, you know, I had this idea that we're connected to the stars. Well, Carl Sagan came up with a good metaphor that we are star stuff, which is true. Except for hydrogen, every atom in our body was cooked up inside of a first-generation star. And then that star dies and blows up and blows all those atoms out into space. And in some cases, that is those dust clouds reformed to form asteroids and eventually planets and suns. That's how our solar system was formed. But it's more than that. David Eamer, at the first Origin of Life conference I went, had a piece of the Murchison meteorite. That was a meteorite that was found near Murchison, Australia. And he put it into a test tube and heated it up with a condenser, you know, cooling coils over it. And you could see steam coming up out of this piece of asteroid. And then he collected that water, put it under a projecting microscope, and you could see that there were fatty acids in there that were forming cell membranes spontaneously. And there were also amino acids and nucleic acids. So this is a pro-life universe. You've got the basic elements of life, amino acids and nucleic acids, formed in outer space. We used to have to worry about how would they form on the planet to get life going. They came here in asteroids, and they were formed in outer space. This one reason why I'm absolutely convinced that we'll find life on other solar systems.
Oh, sure.
How often, I don't know, but we will. What were you going to say?
Well, I was just in agreement with you about finding life in other places in the universe. It seems like a no-brainer, really, at this point in time, with all of the study and what is known so far, anyway.
Incidentally, in connection with that, I was in school at Purdue with Neil Armstrong. I used to go to the Purdue Rocket Society meetings where I saw him, never dreaming that it was the only place in the world where they had a student rocket society, because the American Space Program started at Purdue way in 1946.
Wow.
Which is not widely known, but it did.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let's try and bring this back around to the work you do with the high blood pressure and all of that sort of work. If someone just says, okay, I've heard this interview now and I am definitely interested, I'm going to drop the processed foods, I'm going to find out, and of course that information is in your book, The High Blood Pressure Solution, Foods That Are High in Potassium, and go for it, things will change for them, won't it? I mean, it's that simple, and yet it's not something they can do for a week and expect a change.
Well, the change can happen surprisingly quick, like in 2 or 3 weeks. It becomes obvious it's changing in some cases. But, it's a lifetime change. Basically, this large amount of table salt we're consuming, table salt is a slow-acting poison. That's the best way to look at it. And your body can compensate for it up to a point, but then it begins to fail in its adaptation, and you get into problems. And hypertension is by no means, you know, I use high blood pressure in the title of the book because for legal reasons I had to. The first book was published by Macmillan and had a better title, The K Factor, which is defined as potassium-sodium ratio.
Right.
But I have both written and oral evidence that, it's a historical fact. Macmillan was going to make that their number two book of the year. In 1986, I had a co-author, and they killed it after they had sent me to just the 4 medium-sized cities to promote it and sold 14,000 copies in those, like Cleveland and Dallas cities in just 3 weeks. And I have a letter handwritten from a worker in their warehouse that they had destroyed all the remaining copies. And I know it was a drug company. I know the name of the drug company that made a deal with Macmillan to do that.
Jeez.
And I didn't want to write the damn book in the first place because it meant getting away from my basic research. But this basic research, incidentally, is another example of the importance of basic research, because too much of medical research is not based upon anything fundamental. And in this case, by 1983, a group of us around the world had worked out the importance of this electric current generated by the sodium potassium pump and what its consequences were, to the point that you could convince that if you didn't have enough potassium in a diet, your blood pressure would go up. I hadn't thought of that. It was like a guy called me up one day and asked me if I'd thought about it. And, well, duh, no, come to think of it. It's like 2 + 2 = 4. If you throw that, well, no, I never did. But we could predict it. Even part of the prediction is mathematical. And so we began to look into it and say, you know, well, you just needed to get more potassium in the diet of people with high blood pressure or with hypertension. And we went to the American Hypertension Society. 4 or 5 of us did, and 2 of them were chairmen of basic science departments and medical schools. And they refused to listen to any of us. And that's why the book was written, because I got elected. Nobody wanted to write the book because you knew you were going to get into trouble. The drug companies were going to come after you, although I must admit I was naive and never thought they'd buy out, make a deal with our...
Sure. That's a big step out of bounds, isn't it?
Yeah. Inner Traditions, David Sperling. That was a fortuitous thing. I lived about 20 miles from where Inner Tradition is. Now, when I was on a joint appointment at the medical school at the University of Vermont, a mutual friend put me in touch with Ehud, and he said, well, he wouldn't publicize it, but he would publish the book and keep it in print, which he has.
Wonderful.
Too much medical research is no good, because you've got to do the basic research first. Otherwise, you have no idea what kind of questions to ask in the applied research.
I think also the fact that high blood pressure solution being the title, everyone's going crazy with high blood pressure, what do I do? And people are really starting to look for alternatives. So I think it's great that you have blood pressure solution and high blood pressure solution in your title. Dr. Andrew Weil wrote the book, Spontaneous Healing, and that's all you needed to see. I sort of saw it sitting in huge windows of bookstores in New York City or some other big city, and people walk by and they just see spontaneous healing, and it just goes in there in the consciousness. That's the best part about that book, I think, just to present that idea. There is something else going on here.
In the case of high blood pressure, it's sort of tragic, because I've got the study in my book. In 1985, the British did a really good study of the effectiveness of lowering blood pressure with drugs. A study of 17,000 people who were hypertensive, in which every one of them had their blood pressure dropped to the so-called normal range using drugs. If it didn't, they dropped them out of the study. And they followed these 17,000 people with normal blood pressure due to the drugs for a period of 5 years, and found it made absolutely no overall difference on lifespan or mortality rate. Didn't do any good.
Well, there we go. That's it in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah, and yet you still have... I had a meeting of Richard Lugar, senator from Indiana, who was a friend of mine in high school, and he got me a meeting about a year ago with one of the heads of the NIH, and she was telling me there are studies that show that drugs do prolong lives. And I said, well, show me what the studies are, because I can't find them. You know, I mentioned this one of 17,000 people. That's a big study.
Yes.
Actually, they found there was a slight effect depending on sex. Men had a slight improvement in lifespan, but women had an equally sized slight decrease in lifespan when treated with drugs.
Well, it's like Dr. Ralph Moss, I don't know if you're aware of his work with cancers, when he started looking into the studies, this will increase your lifespan. Well, average was 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. So it's like, okay, well, do you want to actually do this drug and feel like crap for the last 2 years of your life? Or do you want to live the same amount of time minus 2 weeks and feel kind of okay? So it's very elusive out there in the world of pharmaceuticals, needless to say.
Well, when I was in medical school, between my junior and senior year, I didn't have any money. I had to work my way through medical school, so I always had a job, even though I was going to medical school. And my senior year, in the summer, junior to senior year, summertime, I worked in the research labs at Eli Lilly, and it was really good and professional. All the decisions were made by the scientists, and they were basic scientists. And old man Eli Lilly had rewarded six of them with lifetime chairs in which they could do any kind of research. It didn't have to be related to drugs. It could be in quantum physics or anything they wanted to, because they'd done something good for the company. For example, the three guys that figured out how to get insulin into mass production were awarded that. And then my senior year, I worked in the general hospital at night working up patients on the Lilly research ward. And the drug companies were really ethical. Lilly certainly was. If old man Eli Lilly, if it was back then and I went to him with my book, he'd probably take these drugs off the market. But not anymore. About 3 years ago, I was sitting next to a lady on the airplane and talking with her. I was flying back to Purdue. And she turned out to be in charge of research at Lilly's. And I mentioned why I'd worked there, really liked it. And I said, how do you like it? She said, well, I've got 435 days until I can take early retirement, which I think answers that question. And then she pointed out that the MDs who replaced the scientists as their bosses at one point, and they didn't really understand things, but she said we could usually talk them into the right, doing the right thing. But then MBAs and finance people replaced the MDs. And her group had just discovered an enzyme that nobody knew anything about before, even knew it existed, that's present in large amounts in three vital organs, heart, kidney, and liver. And her boss, who's a finance person, told her she had 12 months for her group to find an inhibitor of that enzyme so they could market it as a drug. And as she said, you know, inhibiting that enzyme may be the last thing you ever want to do. Our whole society has been corrupted by this complete emphasis on money.
Yes.
And that includes the drug industry. And then they, in turn, have corrupted the medical schools.
Many thanks to Dr. Richard Moore, author of The High Blood Pressure Solution. His website, hbpsolution.com. And for any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, our presence on the web is now tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.